he's always fearful that someone's going to look at his wife and take her and just kind of push him aside, kill him, get him out of the way so that they can legitimize the marriage to Sarah. However, this is 25 years later than the first occurrence whenever they were in Egypt. So then Sarah was 65, and how was she described in the previous encounter with Pharaoh?
Very fair.
Okay, very fair, beautiful. So 65 years old might have put her in her mid to upper 30s. You know, it's obviously people lived a lot longer back then. So 25 years later, she is 90, 89, 90, if my math is right on that. So a lot of time has passed. She's not described as beautiful in this particular text. Obviously, that's, I feel like in a sense it goes without saying, but she doesn't possess the beauty of youth that she once had. She's not described in this way. What are some other motivators for perhaps Abimelech to take her as a wife? Motivators. What do we know about Abraham?
Very wealthy,
powerful. He's got his own little army, remember? He was able to get, and this is back in Genesis 18, I think, where he gets his little 318 band of army and soldiers and goes after them. So Abraham may be in excess of 1,000 people. He's almost like this little mini nation, if you will. And so Pharaoh probably sees this as some sort of opportunity for a political alliance. And one of the ways that political alliances were formed was through the marriage of one member of royalty to the other. And so since Abraham comes in with the story, this is my sister, she's up for grabs. So maybe there's some sense of wealth and alliance, political arrangement and all of this. So whatever the case was, Abimelech takes Sarah to be his wife. Now, can you appreciate how many times God has had to step in and just save Abraham and Sarah from complete disaster? The integrity of God's promise, which is that through Isaac, your seed shall be called. Remember, they have the promise, but they don't have the child yet. In fact, Sarah's not even, don't believe Sarah's even pregnant at this point. The obvious danger here is if another man takes her, Abimelech takes her to be his wife, then that's going to call into question the fatherhood of this child that's going to be born. That jeopardizes the entire promise. So that everything's called into question and shadows of doubt are cast upon it. And so that's why, in speaking to Abimelech, when he comes to him in a dream, God says, I didn't allow you to touch her. Okay, God physically prevented that from happening because he wanted it clear beyond a shadow of a doubt that Abraham was indeed the father of Isaac. And so once again, God here steps in to save them. And the next morning, Abimelech calls his house together. He informs them of the conversation. And oddly enough, when he calls Abraham, he rebukes him for jeopardizing his entire nation. And you remember what Abraham says, why he told the lie? Remember why that was? Because I didn't think there was any fear of God among these people. Well, as it turns out, he was wrong, because there was a fear of God among this man Abimelech. And he talks about integrity, and yes, he did demonstrate integrity. And he pleads innocence. And it's because of that God says, I let you live, because you acted innocently, you acted ignorantly, and because of the integrity of your character. And so Abraham was very wrong in presuming that there was no fear of God among these people. So he takes them and then gives Sarah back to Abraham. Question six, what did God do to the house of Abimelech on Sarah's behalf? And this is while she lived as a wife, if you will, to Abimelech. What did God do to them? Okay. So he closed her wombs, and then whenever Abimelech, like David pointed out, gave Sarah back, he opened the wombs back up again. Would you read, David, Genesis 20, 14 through 18?
And Abimelech took sheep, oxen, and male and female servants, and gave them to Abraham, even before Sarah his wife to them. And Abimelech said, see, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you. Then to Sarah he said, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver.
Okay. So this was probably one of the means that Abimelech was able to determine something's going on, something fishy is going on here. Then God comes to him directly in a dream and says, hey, that's not his sister you've got, that's his wife. And the conversation there goes on. And so he then summons Abraham and gives Sarah back. However, it was because of Sarah being taken away, that God closed all the wombs. He prevented pregnancy completely among the family and the household of Abimelech. Dad? I'll take the comment.
Okay, the comment is, obviously Sarah was with Abimelech for some period of time. Because if he had closed the womb for a week or two, nobody would have
done it. Yeah.
So it was a long enough period of time.
Something's going on. Nope.
They realized there's nobody coming pregnant anymore. But the question I have is part six. Why did God tell Abimelech, I would tell you from sinning against me? Well, it's not like he is a servant of the Lord who tries to obey with everything that's committed to sin, but he's an unbeliever, or I won't say unbeliever, he's a heathen. And God said, I kept you from sinning against me. Like that was the only sin.
I think that just demonstrates the universality of God's reign. You know, in the Old Testament, it's easy to kind of get focused in on the fact that he's the God of Israel. And yes, he was the God of Israel, but he is also the God of the world. He's the God of the nations as well. And you see that occasionally when you read through some of the prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and many of the others. And in fact, I think of Obadiah. Obadiah is not even written to the Israelites. It's written to the people of Edom. It's God's judgment on the house of Edom because of the way that they mistreated God's people. And so one of the things you see is, even in the Old Testament, yes, he was Israel's God, but he was also judge of all the world. You know, and I think that's how Abraham refers to him whenever Abraham's trying to barter with him regarding the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. He says, "Shall not the God of the universe or the God of the world do rightly?" And so he recognizes God's kingship, and particularly in regard to sin and judgment for sin. I think you know, ultimately all sin exists against God, whether a person believes or not. Their transgressions against God. Even though he was an unbeliever from a nation who didn't worship or serve God, he still, you know, his offense was against God. And primarily when we sin, we may sin against someone. Others may get caught up in that. But the nature of sin is we have to understand first and foremost the affront and the offense is against God. And I think that's why, you know, God comes to him and says, you may not even know who I am, but this would have been sin accounted to you because of who I am, because I'm the judge of not just the people of Israel, but of the entire world, and so you would be held accountable in that sense. That's my thought. Anybody else want to? Tommy?
Yeah, you brought it out when you said all sin is actually sin against God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he takes it very personal.
Yes.
The example of it, when Joseph, Potiphar's wife, is trying to seduce him,
mm-hmm.
and he says, no, that how can I do so great a sin against God?
Right. And yeah, Joseph in Genesis chapter 39 points out sin is first and foremost against God. David in Psalm 51, maybe verse 4, whenever he's repenting, his beautiful prayer of repentance for the sin with Bathsheba. Yeah, he says, against you and you only have I sinned. Now we understand David sinned against a lot of other people aside from Bathsheba. He sinned against Bathsheba, he sinned against Uriah, he sinned against all of the people involved in the lie, but he recognizes sin is first and foremost an affront to the nature of God and who he is. And that's how we need to see sin within our context. And before we ever go and apologize to someone else when we sin, we should repent first and foremost to the Lord. So maybe that brings some clarity to the question, maybe not. So.
I just wonder why it seems without that one particular sin is good with all the others.
Why he singled out that one particular sin?
He doesn't say all the sins you're going to get from me. He just singled out that one particular sin.
Probably because that was the one relevant to the purity of Sarah, I would say.
He wasn't going to allow that to take place.
Yeah, this was the one he allowed him, if you will, free reign in all of those other areas, but he literally intervened, you know, miraculously in this particular instance. I think that's kind of what stands out to me, is that's kind of the one involved in this situation. And Abimelech's going to have to answer for all the other sins, right? And so, assuming he didn't repent through some communication with Abraham, come to know the one true God, so he'll have to answer for all of those. But this one was prevented just due to the nature of it, due to the timing where Sarah is. She's on the verge of conceiving the son of promise, and so God, he's got this big grand plan. And you see this happening all throughout the history. Satan tries to intervene and stop God's salvation of the world. How many times has he tried to destroy the Jews with Haman? You know, Haman tries to destroy the Jews. Pharaoh tries to destroy the Jews. Herod tries to destroy Jesus. You got just read the story of the Bible. You see Satan trying to, through the hands of men, intervene and disrupt God's plan to save mankind. This is just another example where if Satan can purify the bloodline, cast a shadow of doubt on the parentage of Isaac, the whole thing goes up in smoke. And so that's what's going on behind it. And God says, you know, I'm not going to let that happen. God's sovereignty protects the integrity of his plan. All right, question 7. Okay. What was the first thing that Sarah said after Isaac was born? God had made laughter for me. Everyone who hears me will laugh over me. So Genesis 21, let's read 1 through 7. Hey, Tommy, would you mind reading Genesis 21, 1 through 7, please?
Sure. This is from King James. The Lord visited Sarah, as he had said. The Lord did ask Sarah, as he had spoken. Sarah conceived and bare Abraham's son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham called the name of his son that was born to him, whom Sarah bare to him, Isaac. Abraham circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old, as God had commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God hath made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh with me. How far did you say God?
Verse 7. Laughter is significant in this narrative, this Isaac, Sarah, Abraham narrative, right? Where else have we seen laughter?
God told him that he was going
to do. Okay. Both of them laughed, didn't they? I think Abraham fell on his face and laughed. Sarah laughed and she was rebuked for it. In the tent, she laughed and said to herself, you know, can a woman who's beyond the age of childbearing have children? And so laughter really ties in with the narrative here. In fact, she names the child Isaac, which that means laughter. And so laughter plays a part. Laughter's not done in this narrative either. It's about to get rather interesting in the text ahead. And so Sarah names him laughter, Isaac, which means laughter, because she says, people who hear of God's grace bestowed upon me will laugh. And this is, there are different kinds of laughter. There is the laughter of joy, which we see demonstrated here. You know, you're just so happy, you're filled with joy. You know, laughter just is the natural response to that. There's the laughter of disbelief, which we're going to see, which we saw previously when Sarah was in the tent and you know, the Lord's outside speaking to Abraham, and he says, I'm going to, you know, about this time next year, Sarah's going to become pregnant and have a son. So there's the laughter of disbelief. Just a moment, we're going to see a different type of laughter that God is not pleased with at all. Okay, so let's just go ahead and get to that. Question 8, what did Sarah demand of Abraham after she saw Ishmael mistreating Isaac? Tommy, you want to answer that? I saw you were going to raise your hand on 7. You want to do number 8 for us?
Genesis 21, verses 10 and 11, because she wanted to cast out the lot of people and her son.
Okay, good. All right, tell you what, why don't we read, this is a very significant passage here. The implications of it are multiple, and we'll kind of dwell on this for a few minutes. Buster, would you read Genesis 21, 8 through 14, please?
8 through 14.
Yes, sir.
And the child grew and was weaned. And Abraham made a great feast the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, she had born unto Abraham, mocking. Wherefore she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be the heir with my son, even with Isaac. The thing was very grievous unto Abraham's sight because of his son. And God said unto Abraham, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad, and because of the bondwoman, and all that Sarah has said to thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And also of the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation, because he is thy seed. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, took bread and a bottle of water, and gave them to Hagar, put it on her shoulder, and the child, and sent her away. And she departed, and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba.
Thank you, Buster. All right. Around the age of 3, during the ancient Near East culture, that was the common age in which children were weaned, 3 or 4 years old. So Isaac is probably 3 or 4 years old at this time. This was a landmark event. That's why you see this celebration. You know, in our context, we say, well, why would you celebrate the weaning of a child? When you consider the high infant mortality rate during that day and time, you know, we're so far removed from that, thankfully, where within our culture, with medication and medical technology and medical knowledge, we've really, you know, brought that number down to very insignificant compared to what it was in times past. But you know, in times past, this was a very serious thing. And so when a child reached the age of 3 or 4, they were, for the most part, beyond the age of something tragic happening to them in their youth. Okay, and so it's normally, you know, generally smooth sailing from that point in time on. So to celebrate this landmark event, Abraham has a feast, if you will. Okay, remember I said laughing has kind of been the theme here, where Sarah laughed whenever the Lord revealed that she was going to have a son. Abraham laughed whenever the Lord revealed he was going to have a son. Ishmael mocked Isaac. Now, I went and looked at that because I had a suspicion, and that's actually the same word. You go back in the Hebrew, or the Hebrew, that's the same word for the laughing that Sarah did and the laughing that Abraham did and the laughter for which Isaac was named. Okay, and so I said that there's a bad kind of laughing, if you will, and kind of give you a sense of what Ishmael is doing here. Let me give you a couple renderings of that. The ISV says that Ishmael was making fun of Isaac. King James Version says he was mocking. New American Standard says mocking. And the TLB says that he was teasing Isaac. So, once again, this is the same word relating to laughter, but the context bears out there's something more malevolent than just a joyous laughter or a disbelieving laughter. This is a mocking, scornful laughter. This is the laughter that those who those who oppose God, oppose God's people, how they look at God's people and laugh. Okay, and so this is kind of what you've got going on here. So sometime during the midst of the feast, Sarah looks over and she sees Ishmael mocking, laughing at, or teasing Isaac in some manner. Now, Ishmael is what, 13? Is he 10 or 13 years older than Isaac? I think he's 13 years older than Isaac. So if Isaac is 3, this puts Ishmael in the realm of probably 15, 16 years old, something like that. And that sounds like pretty typical older brother behavior. However, Ishmael would have understood the significance of Isaac's birth. He's the son of Abraham, yes, but he's also the son of Hagar, a slave. Isaac is the son of Abraham, but he's also the son of Sarah, who is the wife, the true legitimate wife of Abraham. And so he realizes whatever blessing, whatever birthright he might have had, it's not going to be the case any longer. And so this is not just older brother picking at younger brother. There's some malevolence behind this, and Sarah saw that as well. And that's why you see it rendered as mocked or teased or something like that. It's kind of a negative connotation to it. And so Sarah sees Ishmael teasing or mocking Isaac. And upon seeing this, she realizes that she's had to know this was coming. This is the straw that breaks the camel's back. And she says, no more. Okay. Verse 10, cast a slave woman out with her son, for the son of a slave woman shall not be heir with Isaac. So we've seen this harsh treatment from Sarah to Hagar in the past. Remember whenever Hagar became pregnant and she kind of puffed herself up, and Sarah goes to Abraham and says, this is all your fault that she's acting this way. And Abraham says, you know, do with her what you must. And so she kind of humbles her. We see this kind of treatment in the past from Sarah to Hagar, and we see it here again. This is some strong language that Sarah uses when she says to her husband, cast out the bondwoman and her son. Okay, that casting out is the same sense in which Adam and Eve were cast out of the Garden of Eden back in Genesis chapter 3. So this is some serious, harsh expulsion from society. So let me just kind of ask you, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. What do you make of this? Was Sarah overly harsh?
Pretty harsh.
Yeah. Tommy?
I think it's typically what you would see a mother protecting her child. And as you pointed out, she knows how the rules are.
Yeah.
That Isaac, well, he is the true son. Ishmael is the older son. And she won't want anything to come in between her son and his inheritance.
Okay.
So I think she's been looking reason to run them off.
Yeah. I think you're on to something important. I think there's something deep that's lurking underneath this action. Dave?
Well, if you don't see it in this text, you're not going to see it in the letter. You can see where the change is there. Because Sarah was looking anyway.
It's fine.
Okay. Anyway, so there's obviously something going on with it. So she made a leap in
I think that's what is underneath and undergirds this action. On the surface, yes, it appears harsh. Once again, we have a tendency to see things and read the Bible through our culture, through our lens, and you know, that's one of the reasons I've always thought so poorly of Sarah, because of her mistreatment and her harsh treatment of Hagar. And Dick, I think you're right. I think it was harsh. But at the same time, I think underlying it is this sense of faith. And if you think about what Sarah has been through, any woman that has had to share her husband with a concubine would act as she did. I mean, that's just 99.9999%. That's the way any person in that situation would respond. And I said, I think this is, like Dave pointed out, this is a evidence of Sarah's faith in God's promise. And you know, if mothers, if you were in such a situation, would you have acted any differently than Sarah did? And the answer is probably not, especially far removed from the culture that we know and placed in that culture then. Miss Johnny? It's hard for us to understand the significance that the inheritance plays in our culture so far removed, but that was the thing, you know, during the Jewish culture. You know, the oldest son obviously had the birthright, but more than the birthright, there's a spiritual heritage that's going to be passed on from Abraham to his son. And Ishmael is being overlooked in favor of Isaac. And we see this allegorized by Paul in Galatians chapter 4. In fact, he uses this. And if there's any doubt as to whether what Sarah was doing was right or wrong, it's obviously right, because God gives his divine stamp of approval when he says, he comes to Abraham and says, she's right, send him away. Okay, so if there's any doubt as to if Sarah's acting badly, she's not. I think she's acting in faith. And God comes and says, no, Sarah's right, Ishmael's got to go. Okay, and you know, we all understand from an emotional aspect how that would be challenging for someone like Abraham, who loved Ishmael very greatly. In fact, whenever God comes and says, you're going to have another son, he's going to be the son of promise, Abraham, remember, he says, let Ishmael always live before you. And kind of to smooth over any concern that Abraham has about Ishmael, he says, and this is God's esteem for Abraham, because he's your son, I'll make of him a great nation. Okay, and so he's going to bless Ishmael for the sake of Abraham, and so Abraham is able to send him away with a certain degree of peace of mind, knowing that, you know, and although he's losing the birthright, if you will, God's still going to bless him. Dick?
All that topic, since we're back on Abraham for a second, it always kind of wondered it. He cast him out. Cast them out. He gave them a bottle of water and a little bread, carried it on his shoulder, and they left. And that, in my opinion, that would be almost like, you know, that they're going to go out and die.
Mm-hmm.
But was that the case, or did Abraham have the same faith that he'll have later with Isaac? Did he have faith? God said, do it, I'm going to take care of it. Yeah. God said he'd make him a great nation.
I think so. I think that's the character of Abraham at this point. Here we're in Genesis 21, where you've got him sending away Ishmael and Hagar. Genesis 22 is the event you're talking about, where he takes Isaac up to Mount Moriah and proves his faith there. I think this is the same Abraham. This is the Abraham who, from his call in Genesis chapter 12, left his home and wanders in this land that God promises to give him. And so I think this is a demonstration of faith. God says, I'm going to bless him and make of him a great nation. It's good enough for Abraham. You know, he doesn't have anything to fear. He could have sent him out with absolutely nothing at all, I think, and he would have trusted that God was going to care for him. And as we're going to see, God does divinely intervene and makes provision for them. But I think you're right, that's a good expression of his faith. Now, let me bring out one more point. In Galatians chapter 4, Paul is going to allegorize this event where you've got Ishmael and Isaac, Hagar and Sarah. And he's going to show in Galatians 4, using these two people and young men and their mothers, he's going to show the incompatibility of salvation by works and salvation by faith. And we're talking about a system of salvation. That is, you know, not the single act itself, but a system in which one earns their salvation, or a system in which one is saved through the system of faith in Jesus Christ. And let me share this comment that I came across that expresses it well. It's as harsh as it may have seemed. There is a very crucial, necessary, and positive spiritual principle in the expulsion of Hagar and Ishmael. This symbolized the important truth that the kind of religion that is dependent on human effort, symbolized by carnal scheme, that conceived Ishmael as an artificial fulfillment of God's promise is utterly incompatible with the divine grace symbolized by Isaac and the true heir of God's promise. And the two are so hostile to one another that they cannot abide in close proximity. And so remember, it's the machinations and the thinking of human wisdom that is that brought about Ishmael's birth and conception and birth. And it's the promise of God that brought about that of Isaac. And so you see this incompatibility to dwell together through the workings of man and the plan of God and the means by which God is going to fulfill and accomplish his will. And in Galatians 4, the context is to how man's going to be saved. I'm going to just give you questions 9 and 10, so we won't linger long over them. How long does Sarah live? 127 years. That's in Genesis chapter 23, verse 21. She's the only, to my knowledge, the only woman in Scripture who we knew how long that they lived. And then where was she buried? And that is the cave of Machpelah. And that's where, you know, when she dies, Abraham then purchases a place that will serve as the family cemetery, if you will. And not only Sarah is buried there, he's going to be buried there later. And his the patriarchs of his family as well. David? If you want, we can actually look at that. That's a good place to talk about. It's going to say Machpelah, right? So is Machpelah the place or the person? There was a Hittite that sold him the land. So we'll explore that a little bit. So it'll make a good spot to start next week in our study. And we'll go from question number 10 right into our discussion questions. I wish I had time and I'd answer that for you right here and right now.